It's 9 o'clock. We've got a short session, but we have time constraints, so I want to get started if we can. Let me introduce our board. To the far right, Bill Fenimore. Far left, Bill Fenimore from the Northern Region. Calvin Crandall from the Central Region. Myself, Del Brady, the chairman of the board. Immediately to my right is our director, Greg Sheehan, John Baer next to him from the Central Region, and Mike King from the Southeast Region. We have two members of our board that are not here today. They've been excused. Ernie Perkins is out of town, and Jake Albrecht from the Southern Region is involved with a family funeral. We have the young ladies that have the job of keeping it under control. Stacy Coons over there in the white, and Tu Van Wood to help us with our minutes and whatever. Let me start with our agenda. We have an approval of the agenda from the board.
So move.
I'll second that.
Okay. Let me make one caveat. When we get to other business at the end of that agenda, I want to give a Mr. Dave Gurr from the Uinta Basin a chance to talk about something he's presented. It should be very short, though. So it's been moved and seconded with that. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Approval of the minutes. Last board meeting's minutes, do we have any changes there?
I move that we approve.
Motion made to approve, seconded by Calvin. We'll approve those minutes. Action log. Pass. Oh, yes, let's vote on the minutes. I'm really rolling.
You're all right. You're moving.
That's all right.
Okay. All in favor of the approval of the minutes?
Aye.
As presented? Unanimous?
I think Ernie had sent in an email with some corrections for the minutes.
Yeah, and that was early on or something.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to step past the action log because Ernie's not here.
I think when we talked the other day, said that there wasn't really anything that was up for review today anyway. So.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, now I'm down to item number 4. Director Sheehan will give you a few minutes for an update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Try to move quickly and keep in spirit with the meeting today so we can stay on schedule. But there are a few items I think that are important to cover. One item that I wanted to make the board aware of, there's no action necessary at this time, but it could be something that we do under a director's emergency order, which is potentially extend the brine shrimp harvest season on the Great Salt Lake this year. Our cyst count, or our count of eggs on the lake, is significantly higher than we'd normally expect to see at this time. And when we've seen those triggers in the past, it can lead to a real crash when we enter springtime. So we may extend the season from the end of January till some point, or potentially the end of February. And I did want you to be aware of that in case you see that coming
down.
How
soon do you have to make that decision?
Well, probably fairly soon so that our harvesters can plan accordingly. They often have those employees as seasonal workers, and we don't want them to be moving off. I think we're getting an update or two from out on the lake to see if that's the final decision that we want to make. But I think it's pretty widely supported that would be a wise management move if we do that.
Do you need the board's formal support or want that, or is that something
I don't think you could vote on that, but if you have a voice of acceptance without a vote, since this is not an action item, that, you know.
I would support that.
I would support that, and I don't think this is the first time that's come up, has it? It is,
is it
the first time?
John Leff's our coordinator out at the lake, and hopefully I've communicated this properly. But John, could you come up with the mic and identify yourself?
The numbers that we've gotten through December are the largest by orders of magnitude than we've seen in the past. So what we wanted to do is be prepared in case that happened instead of springing it on the shrimpers as well as our administration before it happens. The season's scheduled to end at the final day of January. We're asking to extend it through February in case those numbers remain high.
And when might you anticipate, from your discussions with the industry, we might want to make that announcement or that action?
I would like to let them know as soon as possible, just so they can arrange for, you know, typically they'll end their or have people leave at the end of January, and they would like to make decisions about whether to keep people on.
All right. Well, I think we'll be able to move forward with that, but certainly wanted to make the board aware of that. Had we had more advance notice, we probably could have created more of an action item on this, but I think it probably would have resulted in the same outcome. So, all right. Thanks, John, on that. This past week and end of last week and over the weekend, several of the board members, including Dell, Ernie and Mike King attended our WAFA meeting, Midwinter WAFA, Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. That's a meeting that we attend, and it gives a good chance for our board members to meet with other commissioners and board members and hear some of their issues and challenges and what's going on in the West, as well as the directors have that same opportunity. So there's good feedback and exchange, and I think that's always an important learning moment as we hear other challenges that are in the West. Earlier this week, the division conducted in the southern region a deer translocation from the Parowan Front area, moved 51 deer up to the area north of Fillmore and Holden area, up along the face up there. This is a research project that was funded by Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife to look at the viability of potentially moving deer in the future to help manage some of our populations. That was very successful. I don't think any deer were lost in that move. And it was cold temperatures, but went well. And I want to thank our employees who were involved and all the sportsmen who came out to help. There was an excellent turnout. I was able to go down on the second day of that and roll up my sleeves and work with some of our sportsmen and division employees a little bit, and that was a very good project. I think it was a good interaction, and that research is being done by Dr. Randy Larson, BYU. It's a three-year study to look at survivability and what's worked here and what hasn't, so I will keep you posted on that.
Are those deer radio collared and collared?
All of the deer are collared, yes.
GPS collars or just
I think some are regular. GPS collared and some are radio collared, if I understand that right. Bruce, is that correct? Okay, yeah, a little bit of both, but they're all collared, so we'll be able to track all those deer and look at dispersion rates and mortality and different sorts of things. So good effort, a big turnout, really I think a great show of support by our sportsmen and our division working together. Along those lines, we had some very cold temperatures as of late. There have not been considerations for deer feeding and other actions. The snow levels, while they pretty much exist throughout the state, are not so deep or so crusted over that we feel like there's been any threat for the deer. And fortunately, I think we're in a little bit of a warm-up here, maybe before this next snowstorm. But hopefully our deer will moving through the winter fine. We did test all of the deer for condition, body fat, and general condition that we moved down in Parowan. I think for the most part, they all still looked pretty healthy, and that was good to see. Legislative update. We're beginning the legislative session here in a couple weeks. There are two bills that we're aware of that that directly affect the division. One is a Robin's here, but I believe it's wasting of wildlife amendments, or maybe I've got those words backwards, but essentially it's a bill that says that on some fish species, such as carp, those can be harvested and not used in a productive manner, and those are for some species that we determine we just need to get out of waterways. So right now we've not been following that too closely from an enforcement perspective, but this gives us an opportunity to operate within the law, and I think that'll be good. The other one that we've got out there is a mentorship bill, which is being run by Senator Christensen, Alan Christensen, and that would allow permits to be transferred by somebody who draws one of our permits to be transferred to a youth member in their family, or a grandchild or a stepchild. We don't have all the language drafted on that yet, so I can't give you lots of details about that. But the concept there is that it's a mentorship and recruitment program. Again, there's still some details we're working through with residency issues and different things, how we'll address bonus points. But I think that would be a good bill that we could be supportive of. Next item, the Hunt Expo is next month. Many of our board members have been involved in some of the activities there, and as well as our division employees. I think that begins the 21st of February next month through the 23rd, I think. I don't know. Someone has the dates, but I think it's 21st through the 23rd or 24th. But that's, again, something that's I think most of you are aware of. Two positions filled. Our assistant directors, I think everyone's aware, Cindy Jensen's retired, and we're having her retirement party at 1:30 today. For those of you who'd like to attend that, I would encourage all of you to stop by and say hi to Cindy. It'll be in the room right behind the farthest room of the auditorium here. So, again, that'll be at 1:30 today. Replacing Cindy and Alan Clark, who moved up to the department, is Mike Canning and Rory Reynolds, both long-term Division of Wildlife employees, both with strong habitat backgrounds but have worked in other areas of our division. I think they'll do a great job. I know they'll do a great job, and we're working through the assignments of who they'll be supervising as far as regions and sections, and we'll probably make some announcements. Well, I think we have announced that just today, so I won't go through that, but all of you have probably seen an email or will see an email on that. So excited to have them on board helping us move forward. Last thing I have is for the board is we will be authorizing a smaller depredation elk hunt on some cow elk down in Sanpete County that have gotten themselves into trouble. And so we're going to try to do some high-intensity pressure hunt on them to try to get them back where they belong rather than having to harvest too many of those. But certainly some will be harvested through that process. And
where's that at?
John, is John Fairchild here in the audience somewhere? Someone from the center?
Where's that? Gunnison.
So Gunnison, for the record, that area there. So that'll be beginning pretty shortly, I believe. Rory, do you know when that first day is? Or, okay. So we'll be working off a depredation pool on that. Rory, can you come and say that and say your name?
Rory Reynolds. John's not here today. He's working to set up the depredation hunt that will, I must presume, operate on with the depredation hunter pool, starting that process today. So
again, we're trying to push a high intensity in there, basically get a bunch of hunters, and elk seem to be pretty responsive to being shot at, so we're hoping that they'll go back up on the mountain. That's all I had today, Mr. Chairman. I apologize if that went
Thank you, Director. My apology for our rack chairs. I failed to introduce them. Rob smiled. It's not the first time I've made a mistake, is it, Rob? So we got Rob Burns over here from the northern rack, Floyd Coles from the northeast rack, Fred Oswald from the central rack, Darris Jones from the southeast region, and Steve Flinders from the southern region. We're glad to have all of you here today. But I'm going to move to item number five on our agenda, which is our first presentation, Falconry Guidebook, Jim Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, members of the RAC, division staff, and others in attendance today, we have a single action item with Rule R-65720, the rule that regulates the practice of falconry in Utah. We've sent a letter out to all of the falconers. We've also directed them to the website where they could see a copy of the revisions that were our recommendations to the rule. And they've been involved with this process as we've gone through to make these changes. You should have a redline copy in your packets, and that looks very, very busy. Most of these are editorial types of recommendations. There are a couple of exceptions, and so they're really not that extensive. But as we went through preparing the guidebook, we noticed some conflicts and some errors that came up with certain areas. There were some sections that needed to be combined, and some of these things have been around for a little while. We wanted to clarify the language and some other sections and general edits, and then there was at least one compliance issue, which I'll mention with one of our other rules, and we wanted to address that. And so the major points, though, the first one is with minimum age conflict, and that's in sections 3, 9, and 25 of the rule. Last year, the Fish and Wildlife Service lowered the minimum age from 14 to 12. We did comply with that, but 14 remained in certain sections of the rule. And so our recommendation is to update the rule to reflect the 12-year-old minimum age requirement to be consistent with federal rule. On non-resident clarification, that's in Section 4. The current rule language implies that we issue a non-resident COR for falconry. We do not, nor have we ever issued a non-resident COR. So we've revised that section to take that language out, and we don't issue those. And we do have provisions in the rule where a non-resident comes to Utah to establish residency in Utah. We do have provisions for that. But in terms of issuing a COR to a non-resident, we don't do that. So we're recommending removing that non-resident COR language in that portion of the rule. Facilities inspection, the current language instructs individuals to schedule an inspection in their region by contacting the region either by mail or email. The general practice is to do that through a phone call, that they call in and actually do a phone request for a CO to do the inspection. So we're recommending to change the rule to reflect the procedure of the way things are actually done today. The one item, though, that I would like to read into the record involves Section 10 on the sponsor program. That's really a new section. The sponsor program is part of the apprentice class COR, where the entry-level class individuals must have a sponsor. The language in the sponsor portion of that section of the rule was a little bit unclear. And then with the minimum age and talking to Marty, we added some language to cover someone that's under the age of 18, and it does read, any person sponsoring an apprentice under the age of 18 other than the minor's parent or legal guardian must be approved in writing by the minor's parent or legal guardian and submitted to the division before being designated as the minor's sponsor. And so we're recommending that that language, that section be a standalone section and that language be incorporated into the rule. Reporting requirements. In the existing rule, there are essentially the same reporting requirements scattered out through various sections. And so we've combined that into one standalone section, Section 21, and recommending adding that as a new section where all the reporting requirements for the falconers are in the same place. should make it more user-friendly in terms of finding out what they need to do in terms of reporting. Similarly, with banding, there was some confusion and some clarification needed on the banding requirements. And in Section 2 and 23, we've clarified that with some new language as well. I mentioned one compliance issue. That's in Section 22 with an unintentional take. If the falconer releases their birds and the bird takes something other than the intended quarry, if there's a challenge there, the current rule states that they have 5 days to report that incident to us, but that was out of compliance with the fur bearer rule, which has similar language for a similar event of 48 hours. So we're recommending to change the falconry rule from a 5-day reporting requirement to 48 hours to be in compliance with the fur bearer rule. And other than some editorial changes and clarifications, that's really all we have. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I just have one question, and it doesn't have to do with the changes, but about how many falconers do we have in Utah right now?
By the end of December, we had right at 200. We've gone between about 2 and 250 the last few years. So.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Any other question from the board? Question from the rack chairs? Okay. Any questions from the audience? Okay. And during our discussion today, if there are any individuals in the audience that want to have a comment or a question, if you will fill out one of the orange cards, and I assume they're over here, and bring them forward, then we can have you come up. With that, have the rack chairs report. Steve, can we start with you?
Sure, Mr. Chair. We passed it as presented unanimously.
Okay. Darius from the Southeast.
Southeast also recommended that the Wildlife Board approve the falconry guidebook as presented.
Thank you. Fred from the Central Region.
Central Region passed it unanimously, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Floyd from the Northeast.
Northeastern Region passed it unanimously.
Ed and Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Northern Region recommended that you pass it unanimously.
Okay. All the rack chairs racks have all voted for that presentation unanimously as presented. Have no comment. We have a board discussion. No discussion. I assume somebody's ready to make a motion.
I'll make a motion that we approve the falconry
second
rule as presented.
Okay, Mike's made a motion. Bill seconded that we approve that presentation as given from the DWR. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you,
Jim. Next, we'll go item number 6, the hunting and fishing accommodations for people with disabilities. Kenny Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members, RAC members, members from the public and division employees. This, don't blink, this one will be pretty quick too. This is our R657-12-7. It's special, it's the accommodations we make for hunters and fishermen with disabilities. And the first one, excuse me, we will be discussing is special season extensions for turkey specifically. What we want to do, the language in the existing rule is obsolete. In years past, we would go through and we would find a weekend we wanted to do the season extension on, and then we would update the rule with specific dates. And we kind of wanted to get away from having to do that administratively every 3 years to put specific dates in the rule. So we wanted to remove that obsolete language, give us a little bit more flexibility for when that extension could happen. And what we're proposing is to have the extended turkey season be the 7 days prior to the limited entry hunt as it's listed in the guidebook. So moving forward, the intent of that is to just write it in there that we can do the extension that 7 days prior. The actual CORs we issue may still have the dates issued as the weekend prior, but we just wanted to build in some flexibility and some standardization moving forward. And what this does, we've met a lot with these groups and these constituents, and what they've asked for essentially is people with who need these accommodations with certain disabilities and mobility impairments, they've asked for a chance to go hunt with a little bit less pressure and have some of those days be a weekend. And so we think this is a great compromise and kind of puts us right in line with what they've asked for and what we can do biologically. And then we'll move to subsection 8, crossbows and draw locks for qualifying disabilities. And what we want to do here, we're proposing to add carp to the list of species approved for crossbow take. And this is for people with disabilities only.
And we ask you a question about that real quick.
Sure.
If we're trying to get rid of carp, why can't anybody use a crossbow or a draw lock?
I think that's a good question. I think that's... this specifically is the place to start with the rule where we're already addressing crossbows for physical limitations, but I think that's a discussion we're going to have in the future.
Yeah.
And so for now, yeah, that's kind of where we're at. We just want to add fishing as a recognized season in the existing rule, and then a couple stipulations with the crossbow themselves. We want the reel to have line capable of tethering that bolt so it doesn't ricochet and bounce around all over the lake. And restrict the flight distance, and then a positive safety mechanism so if they are using them out on the water, they're a lot safer. And lastly, we'll go down to 10. This is our fishing license for veterans with disabilities, and this is kind of a fulfillment of a promise we made to you guys a year and a half ago to assess our discount for veterans, see what the impact was, and then see if we couldn't, you know, continue to develop that program. And so subsection 10, currently veterans with 40% service-connected disability ratings get a $5 reduction in season fishing license price. Since 2011, when we began selling them in July, about 93 veterans have actually taken us up on that and purchased a discounted license. That impact was not significant on the resource or on the revenue. And so what we're proposing to do with this little rule change is to lower the service-connected rating from 40% down to 20% and include those with a little bit less service-connected disability rating. Thank you.
Any question from the board? Question from the rack chairs. How do we have anybody in the audience with a question?
I do have a question. Sorry. I apologize about that. What's the process that these individuals go through to have this 20 to 40% problem evaluated? I'm assuming that's a medical evaluation.
That's a good question. For the veterans specifically with disability, they're each issued from their service branch an official federal statement that says rating is this high, and they have that with them. And the process now is to show that to one of our regional offices as proof, and then they can offer the discount. We've since kind of tweaked that a little bit. We found out they didn't love to run to a region office, and so we let them mail us a copy of that and take that as evidence.
But the determination is something that the military does.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? I have no comment cards. Let's see. Back chairs. Let's start with you, Robert. You want to report?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion from the Northern Region is to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-12 hunting and fishing accommodations for people with disabilities as presented.
Thank you.
Yes.
It passed unanimously.
Lloyd?
Northeastern RAC They passed the recommendation from DWR unanimously, and we also had a motion which was passed to present to the board a recommendation from Mr. Gurr on his recommendation for surrendered tags on limited entries to be could be donated back to a disabled veteran. And Mr. Gurr is here today, and I just wanted to give you a heads up. And with this recommendation, we took a vote on it, and it passed unanimously for Mr. Gurr's recommendation. So I'll let him later discuss this. And just a heads up.
We're going to do that under other business when we're done. Fred?
Mr. Chairman, in the Semper Act, there was a motion to recommend that the Wild Boar Board approve R-657, and that passed unanimously.
Thank you. Darris?
Southeast Region also voted to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the hunting and fishing accommodations for people with disabilities. They also had a follow-up motion from building from the discussion from a comment from the public. The meeting was in San Juan County. It was attended by a couple different guiding outfits down there. And they evidently have taken disabled hunters out on a commercial venture in the past. And their discussion resulted in a motion to allow a specified companion hunter to finish off a wounded animal for a disabled hunter who is either paraplegic, quadriplegic, blind, or has lost the use of upper extremities. In the discussion, it was a little vague as far as the, what currently was allowed through division rule. And if covered by current rule, everybody was satisfied that it's okay. If it isn't covered by current rule, the Southeast RAC would like the board to consider allowing this specified companion hunter to take care of a wounded animal so that you aren't torn between being illegal and humaneness of finishing off an animal.
Okay, thank you. Steve from Southern Region.
Mr. Chair, we passed it as presented by the division unanimously.
Okay. Let me summarize. The RAC chairs have approved unanimously their DWR presentation on this with an addition from the Southeast Region that a motion regarding the finishing off of a wounded animal. Northeast Region had an additional motion, which we'll hear later from Mr. Gurr, about transferring of tags. Do we have any discussion from the board on that?
I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more discussion about the finishing off a wounded animal issue. I mean, to me it makes sense, but I'm curious as to what actually is allowed, like Darris said, under current rule, and whether or not this has been looked at in the past by the division. I'm sure it has. I'm sure it's come up at some point in time, but I'm curious as to the...
I'd be happy to...
Go ahead.
Talk to that a little bit. We address it in a couple locations. One is on the certificate of registration where you can take from a vehicle. It's one of the accommodations we make in that same rule. And we do talk about it there that, you know, the intent is we know it's hard to get somebody with mobility impairment and wheelchair out to the game all the time. And so the intent is to make sure as close to as possible, we don't have grandpa sitting at camp 10 miles away and then people hunting for him out in the field. And that's kind of what we're trying to avoid. And so we address it a little bit there. We say that as close as possible, the person, to kind of get to what Darris was talking about, the other certificate of registration where we address it is there is one that's called companion hunter. And for people who with paraplegia, blind, they can actually, if they can't physically use any legal hunting weapon, they can apply for a companion hunter who can actually shoot for them. And it's not really fleshed out exactly what has to happen after the shot, but what has to happen as the shots happen is the person with the disability has to be as close to in proximity as possible. And then after that, you know, we realize there's going to be extenuating circumstances where they may wound something and it takes off. And the idea is just to have that person as involved in that hunt as possible. So we do talk about it a little bit in both places. We don't have a specific rule that says if you wound something, somebody else can go do X, Y, Z with it. But we do talk about it a little bit in that existing rule.
So if a guiding service does take a disabled person on a hunt and everything goes according to plan except the shot is not fatal and according to rule, then would the guide, if he had to walk over the hill and finish off the animal, be subject to any citation?
That's a fair question. I'd probably have to defer to law enforcement on that one and case by case. I think they're probably better equipped to answer that.
Yeah, that's the issue, right? So I guess if
the intent,
that's something I need to understand.
The intent currently is to definitely have the person with the permit and with the accommodation be as close to that harvest process as
right.
possible.
I understand that. I'm just wondering about the liability of the guide if he does make that decision to humanely kill the animal rather than waste it.
Let me invite Marty up, Bushman, our legal counsel. Marty, can you address that and give us some input there?
Thank you. Kenny was right on. We do have accommodations in rule that allow for companion hunting. And anytime we get into the area of allowing one person to take an animal on another's license, we've got to amend statute to do that. The statute says you can't lend, sell, or transfer any of the rights associated with a license or permit or tag. So companion hunting, as it's set up in statute and rule right now, applies only to a person with a disability that's so severe they can't use a legal weapon. And in that case, they can come in and get a COR for the companion to shoot that animal. Now, the situation I think we're talking about here is, let's say somebody is paraplegic but still can shoot a weapon but has lost a lot of mobility. If they wound the animal and can't get to it, can somebody else shoot it? And right now under the existing law, no. It would be unlawful for another person to shoot that. We would probably have to amend statute to create that exemption and then write a rule for it. Whether law enforcement would exercise discretion in that case and, you know, see the circumstances and elect not to issue a citation, that may well be the case. But
okay, thank you. Any questions? Marty, well, we got him. Okay, thank you. My thought there is that maybe we need to, and I think it's a valid point, Darris. It's a very valid point that needs to be addressed, and I think maybe that what we ought to do as a board is at least pass a resolution request to put it on the action log and ask the DWR to go back to that and address that specific issue so we can in some way or another take care of those situations. I could imagine that happening every once in a while. And I'm certainly would suspect that most of our COs and whoever else would take existing circumstances in under consideration, but we need to protect anybody that's trying to salvage that animal.
I would make a motion to that effect, and in the spirit of trying to eliminate some conflict that everybody has to go through that would be put in that position. So I would make the recommendation that we add that to the action log.
Do I have a second? John, second. Calvin?
No, I'm good with that. I was just going to ask, does that happen very often? I mean, it's possible. Do we have any instances where somebody has had that, had to explain their way out of a situation to a conservation officer, has received a citation for doing that, or?
I don't know of any. Maybe Mike or somebody. I don't know of any that have come across my desk, and I deal with probably.
And maybe the conservation officer in the field recognizes that, hey, yeah, this is the situation. We're not going to cite you for that.
Mike?
Yeah, I know of no instances where that's occurred, but the officers would use their discretion.
I can say, and they have the ability to do that, to say, yeah, well, it's obvious that you can't get to it, so yeah, if you can have somebody else go finish that off, that'd be acceptable.
Right, based on the level of the disability and,
exactly,
and the circumstances at hand.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, that's fine with me, as long as it gets interpreted systematically and similarly.
Let me just say this. We've had a motion to put it on the action log. It's been seconded. I'd like to call a vote on that so we at least get it in record that we can turn it back and have the powers to be the DWR look at that and see if something does need to be done. I'm not saying that it has to be, but I think we ought to address it and ask it to be done. So all in favor of that motion? Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
There was one other thing brought up that I think might be appropriate to have added to the action log, too, and that is the use of crossbows to take carp. And also, it keeps coming up. I get asked about it fairly often, is the use of crossbows during the rifle hunt. And I think we have a year till next November, till our Bucks and Bulls meeting. I think it might be appropriate to go ahead and put it on the action log that we look at the use of crossbows to take carp by anybody, not just disabled, and also allow anybody to use crossbows during the general season deer hunt, which would be the any legal weapon hunt, and whether or not we want to make that any legal weapon. I think we have adequate time to look at that, and I think now might be an appropriate time to go ahead and add that to the action log.
Is a crossbow a legal weapon?
For some people, Marty. I would be interested to hear what Marty has to say, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
A crossbow, you know, for taking big game is not legal unless you qualify as a disability archery permit where you can't draw a bow. But it's currently not. This is an issue we have been looking at for quite some time, the division, myself. And actually, I have drafted a rule that would allow the use of a crossbow and a draw lock during an any weapon hunt. Not during the archery hunt.
Sure, during any weapon.
During an any weapon hunt, and we're still kind of evaluating how do we want to deal with the muzzleloader hunt. Do you allow a crossbow, which would be a less effective weapon during a muzzleloader, or we just keep it? So we're kind of working through that process in how we want to work, you know.
Okay, so.
But it's already in the process happening.
So am I interfering with your process by adding it to the action log, saying we want the division to look at that and then hear back in November before the big game proclamation? Does that go hand in hand with what you're doing? Are we okay there? Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion that we add that to the action log also, the use of crossbow for carp by anyone, along with the draw lock, and also the use of a crossbow during the any weapon, any legal weapon season, which most people would consider the rifle season during general season deer.
Okay. Do I have a motion or a second on that? Bill seconds that motion. Motion.
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we did.
I have a question about that. Do we need time frame associated with those, or just
John did on this one.
Yeah, by the Bucks and Bulls meeting next year, that we'd be able to talk about it then.
Mr. Chairman, I think if we want to move forward with that, which I think would be a good thing to look at, I think that would be a good deadline, but certainly we would probably address it much sooner than that so we could have some opportunities for public input and kind of a process review so we weren't dropping it on you right at the Bucks and Bulls. So you can establish what date you'd like, but we may come back to you earlier rather than later on that. So that's well addressed.
I don't think anybody would care if it came back earlier.
No, I guess just leave that to the discretion of the division for how soon you want to do that and when you want to bring it up.
Marty, we want to hear from you next meeting, I think is what he's saying.
He's already got it on his computer. Okay, with that discussion, let's have a vote on that. All in favor? Okay, it's unanimous. Thank you. Then,
I guess we need to.
Yeah, we need to vote on the rest of
the actual proposal.
Yeah, we took care of the sub questions or sub motions. So let me ask for a motion on the balance of that presentation for disabled persons as presented by the DWR.
Mr. Chairman, I think it was a great presentation. I appreciate the work they've done on this. I'll go ahead and make the motion that we accept as presented by Mr. Johnson.
Okay. Bill seconds. All in favor? Okay, it's motion passed that we accept unanimously the DWR presentation. Next item, Stacy Coons, item number 7. Certification Review Committee. Come to the microphone and state your name.
Stacy Coons, I'm the chairman for the Certification Review Committee, and I'm here to present two variance requests for you today. And if it's all right, I'd just like to do them at the same time since they have a lot of things in common. One is from Carmen Smith from the Best Friends Sanctuary. The other is from Webb Parton out of Arizona. Both of these individuals are currently
providing... The shirt's bright, Stacy. Come on.
Sparkle, sparkle. Anyway, both of these individuals have currently been providing the service to the state of Utah over the past years. They've just been doing it as a subcommittee on a certificate of registration issued to Mr. James Dix. And what they would like to do is have their own certificate of registration so that they can work independent from him. Carmen Smith currently relocates nuisance rattlesnakes from areas of the Best Friend Sanctuary that the public would come in contact with to other areas of the Best Friend Sanctuary where they would not come in contact with the public. So she's not killing them. She's not placing them on someone else's property to become a nuisance for them. They're keeping it within their area, just moving them. And the committee had no concerns with her level of experience or education doing that, and she has agreed to train her additional staff to do the service the same way that she's been doing it, so she plans on having subcommittees on her COR if that's approved by you. Webb Parton provides a training for dogs for rattlesnake awareness. He has been doing this training for the state of Utah for the past few years, but he's been required to use the rattlesnakes from Mr. James Dix, and what he would like to do is be able to use his own rattlesnakes as well. The committee met with him back in December. They had no significant concerns on his education or level of experience. And he has agreed to provide the division with an itinerary with his dates of the trainings and the dates that he'd be in the state with his snakes prior to coming. He also carries insurance on the snakes that he's bringing with him. He provided proof of that, and he's aware of all of the permits that he would need to bring them in and out of the state. And he does this training for multiple states in the West, so he's aware of those requirements as well and has agreed to all of them. He has also agreed to add an educational component to his presentation specifically concerning rattlesnakes in the state of Utah. And the committee was pleased with that. So we ask that you approve both recommendations for these two individuals. That's it.
Any questions first?
Just one question. How big is, how many acres is this Best Friends
place? I have no idea.
Curious. That's a lot of snakes in an area. I'm just wondering how concentrated they are.
It's fairly large.
Bruce, do you have an approximation on that?
Where is it at? Where is this located?
Canab.
Bruce, could you come up?
Where?
Sorry.
Canab, according to the letter.
I don't know the exact acreage, but I mean, it's large. It's like maybe half a section. This thing's big.
12 already this year. 78 in 2000. Go down there for a picnic.
Okay. It's a large area.
A large area.
It's up here in Demary. And it's just north of Kanab. 89 there.
The director was wondering how many of those snakes were named Stacy.
None, but there's a few named John.
If I report a nuisance rattlesnake, they'll come and get it and take it clear back to Kanab.
They only do it on their own property. They're only moving them from... They have an area that's like a visitor-type center where the public walks through. They're moving them from areas that the public's coming in contact with them on their sanctuary to areas that the public would not be in. That's all they're doing.
On their own sanctuary.
On their own sanctuary. They just need permission to transport and relocate rattlesnakes.
They're not killing them. They're nothing. Just relocating them.
They're not making hat bands or wall hangings. They're just relocating.
Gift shop, so I'm pretty sure they're not.
Yeah. Director Sheehan said, don't walk out in the bushes.
Yeah. Be careful out.
Stay on the trail.
Stay on the trail.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions from the board? Questions from the RAC? I guess it didn't really go to the RAC, did it?
It doesn't go to the RAC.
Didn't go to the RAC. Okay. Do we have any questions from the audience? Okay. And you talked about, too, the fellow from Arizona and then the...
And Carmen Smith from Best Friends.
Yeah, from the Friends of Animals or whatever, Best Friends, whatever it is.
Something like that.
Okay. Can we get a motion? Bill, do you want to make?
I just want to add, Ernie had written that he's very supportive of this initiative. He's had experiences with dogs and rattlesnakes that have not went well. So he'd love to be able to go to someone who could do aversion training and help people keep their dogs safe.
Yep, I agree.
I was less than enamored with the tone of the letter. For what it's worth, looked to me like that he was not real happy with the system, but perhaps I was tired when I read it, so for what it's worth. But I'm supportive of the program.
Okay, we need to get a motion on what Stacy just presented to us.
Mr. Chairman, I would make the motion that we approve... that we, along with the committee, and approve these CORs for both individuals.
Both individuals.
Yes.
Bill, you'll second it?
And both of these organizations have liability insurance.
Yes. Okay, all in favor of that motion? It's unanimous again, so the motion has been unanimously approved for both.
Thank you.
Recommendations now. Go to item number 8, Kevin Bunnell on the Bighorn Sheep Conservation Permit, Season 8.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a continuation of the vote that you made last month to approve the conservation permits. The next step after you guys approve all the permits is we put together a contract with each of the organizations that has conservation permits, in which we ask them to review season dates, and it's the most detailed review that they get in the process. And through that review process, it was brought up that sheep permits, bighorn sheep permits in the past, since 2005, have always had an extension for the conservation permits through the end of December. It's largely for marketing of these permits, allows some flexibility for the permit holders. Hasn't been anything that's caused any controversy in the past, but it does at times increase the value of the permit to someone, which for bighorn sheep is important to us. with the number of bighorn sheep permits that we are able to provide through the draw and whatnot, it's not a self-sustaining program. So it's probably the one species in the state that really relies on the sale of conservation permits just to allow us to do the management that we need for bighorn sheep. So according to the conservation permit rule, this is a variance that has to be requested by the groups. So I'm acting in their behalf today for the three groups, four groups that have, three groups, Utah FNAS, Safari Club International, and Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation all have at least one either Rocky Mountain or Desert Bighorn Sheep permit for 2013 through 2015. So what the request is that the board continue the variance that's already been in place for almost 10 years now for this next group of sheep permits. So that we don't have to continually do this. My suggestion, and I will make a commitment to remember to do this next time we open up the rule, I think we ought to just, this has been indoctrinated in the rule already, let's just make it part of the rule so that we don't have to try to remember to do it once every 3 years when we're doing the multi-year conservation permits. But for now, to be in line with the rule as it stands, the board needs to act on this variance request. So be glad to answer any questions.
Question from the board?
John. Kind of to throw in my two cents with what Kevin said, I think this variance is important to the sustaining of the program. A lot of guys that buy these tags, I mean, if we're going to sacrifice them to the money gods, we just as well drain them for every cent we can get out of them. And it does add to the value a lot. And I think, like you mentioned, this species, or these two species, above any other, really rely on the permits, the conservation permits. And I think that it's imperative that we have this extension.
I think the division's comfortable with it because it doesn't give an advantage in terms of a better time of year to hunt. All of our public bighorn sheep permits already go completely through the rut. This is really time after the rut, so it's actually a harder time to hunt than what the regular season dates are. It's really just a flexibility issue.
It does allow for flexibility in scheduling,
right,
to a lot of people that come from all over the world to hunt these animals,
right,
and buy
these
tags.
That's really what it comes to.
And that's where it adds the value is the added flexibility.
If we were putting them in the rut and the public wasn't able to hunt during the rut, we wouldn't be in favor of it, but that's just not the case. So,
any other questions on that? I agree with you, John. Personally, I agree with you. It's a good thing. See a lot of interest in those tags, and certainly those species depend on those tags to a large extent. Do we have any questions from the rack chairs or anybody from the audience? Robert?
Just one question. I know the variance rule was changed in the last year, so if there is any effect on your ability to grant this type of season extension with the change.
This is a variance that this is part of the conservation permit rule. It's where the variance is required. It's not part of our overall variance rule. It's a variance that's required that the board act on within the conservation permit rule. But I think we're in good shape there is the answer.
As long as Marty says it wasn't affected by the change, then I think you're good.
Okay. Marty's busy working on the crossbow thing, so.
Mr. Bushman, are you okay with that? Okay, thank you. All right, move on. Let's, it didn't go through the racks, did it? No, it didn't. Either you last two went through the racks. I have no common card, so let's call for a vote.
Mr. Chairman, I would propose or make the motion that we accept the variance as presented by Kevin.
I'll second that.
Motion made to accept the presentations for the conservation permit variance for the presentation, seconded by Calvin. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
On a record pace.
You can have a runaway if you don't watch it.
It could very well be.
Anybody have to drive 3 hours across that mountain today with a storm coming?
Outrun it.
Okay. Other business. That's our agenda. Other business.
Didn't we have something from the Northeast region? Say something.
Yes, and I'm going to get to that. Yes. First, Mike, do you want to give the board an update on the winter wofer, just a brief summary of what?
I can just give you a brief summary, and Dale can pitch in wherever he wants to. Dale and I both attended the commissioners' committee meeting, a subcommittee of WAFWA, and during the day and a half that we met with the commissioners by ourselves, and then also we had a joint meeting with the directors of the different state agencies. I think there were, 16, 18 states represented there, so it was pretty good representation. The issues that I saw coming out of this were very similar to what we saw at the summer WAFWA meetings, but the states, commissioners and directors are very concerned about federal intervention into states' abilities to manage wildlife, particularly coming from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as it relates to Endangered Species Act, which is nothing new to us. We've all had those kind of discussions before. And those came out quite commonly as we went through the different state reports and heard that. And so that continues to be an issue, I think, that WAFWA as a group is going to be looking at and trying to deal with those kind of conflicts and concerns that arise as a result of that. There obviously are endangered species concerns throughout the western United States. One of the interesting ones that was mentioned, I thought anyway, was one, a situation I haven't heard of before, and that is in Alaska. The director made a brief report, and he talked about the petitioning that probably will occur here in the next little while to list ring seals as threatened or endangered. The population of those right now is in the millions. I can't remember exactly, 3 or 4 million.
Between 3 and 7 million.
Right now, the basis for the petition to list these animals and to designate critical habitat is based on a projection that in 50 years from now, as a result of global climate change, water levels are going to change on those habitats, and the habitat needs to start being protected now to address that in the future. So that's kind of the...
Can we make a motion to oppose this right now?
Is the habitat just the ocean in general?
Well, then the land where they haul out to pup and things like that. So anyway, that was pretty interesting. And Alaska probably has more of these concerns than anyone else. But nonetheless, those kind of issues were discussed just a little bit. And I'm very interested to see the progress on that. That was a new one on me. So a couple of other things that came up within the commissioners committee meeting, Ernie introduced some proposed changes to the bylaws that govern the commissioners committee that would try to help make it a little bit more stable. It's hard to get a continuing group of folks there that know what's going on to make sure that the meetings that we have at WAFWA are meaningful and they're well prepared, and advertisements to the different states are made. And so Ernie introduced that, and I'm not sure, Greg, we weren't at the business meeting, and I don't know if that was adopted or even acted upon by the directors in the business meeting on the changes to the bylaws for the WAFA subcommittee of commissioners.
I think that was voted on and passed, but I'd have to check for sure.
It was just some minor things, and I think what that did was create a steering committee that would look at setting up these meetings and doing the organizing and making sure that we followed through on the topics that were recommended for discussion by the commissioners and making sure that we had folks there that could address those issues and help us understand them a little bit more clearly. Because Ernie was quite vocal, I was asked to be on that steering committee. And apparently, since if that was approved, then I guess I might be on that steering committee, which is a subcommittee of the commissioner's committee. The only other thing that I would report on was that we proposed from Utah a topic for summer WAFWA, which will be held in Nebraska. I believe Omaha is where it's going to be. I never did get a location, but I'm assuming it's Omaha. That one of the topics that the commissioners discussed was how economic factors, economic impacts affect wildlife management decisions, and a discussion of that and how maybe we need to consider some of the local impacts to the economies based on management decisions that we make and so on. And that was accepted by the committee, and I'm assuming, I don't know how, again, the outcome in the business meeting where they probably voted on that. And the other item that they, Dale, can you remember specifically the other two things that they talked about had to do along the lines with making the WAFWA commissioners committee
it had to do
more
with
effective
continuity and having someone that had been there before to be there to help assist and take charge so that you don't have a new face on the front line every year or whatever.
And then Arizona
reinvent the wheel.
Arizona proposed a couple of topics that had to do primarily, I think, with the effectiveness of the commissioners committee and how they could respond to some of these challenges that face us all, whether it's endangered species concerns or other things like that. So I'm assuming that might get some discussion too. How WAFWA could better interact with their federal agencies, maybe even at the national level, as they address some of these concerns. So that's what I would report at this time. Pretty interesting to see all of the different things that the different from the different states. The commissions are all very, very different from each other. Their responsibilities are very different, and to see how those different restrictions affect the way that we deal with common issues is pretty interesting.
Let me just say one of the things that I was interested in there. Ernie Perkins gave a presentation on our conservation permits that we have in Utah and what it does, the funds and dollars that it generates for conservation, habitat, and whatever. I'm surprised, but several of the states talked to us after this. Our sportsmen would never let us do that, you know, and yet it has done, in my mind, a lot of good for the state of Utah when you figure the hundreds of thousands of acres and the millions of dollars that's been spent on habitat improvement. But there are people out there that don't agree with us. Most of them are running behind us as far as taking care of the habitat, too, to be honest with you, because they don't have the money. But it was a very interesting meeting. Do you have anything, Director?
Let me just say one more thing. Sorry to interrupt. But another thing along those same lines that raised quite a few eyebrows was our our predator control program, the coyote bounty program. States were amazed that something like that could even be approved. Many of the states have lost their ability to trap, and many of the states indicated that there would be a huge public outcry if something like that were to be presented to their states. So pretty interesting to see the diversity.
You have anything, Director?
I, of course, attended the Director's Committee meetings, and I think they share some of the discussions that were held by the commissioners and board members, and I won't go through all those different items, but one item that they did have each state speak to was our relationships with our NGOs or non-governmental organizations and how we interact with those groups, some of the positive things that are coming about from those relationships, some of the challenges and problems that are created there, and certainly that doesn't, in some cases, deviate too far from this conservation permit discussion. But I think most states at this point have some level of conservation permits, not all, but most. But certainly we have more than the other states, and I think that quickly rises to a topic. But it's interesting, those conservation permits in some states, like Wyoming, that issue those permits don't require those funds to come back to the state wildlife agency or even to the, a sportsman's group. So I think that's why that sometimes there's some misunderstanding from one state to the next of, did we give these permits to some charity or other things that are raising money for themselves, and why is that good for wildlife? And that's certainly not the model that we've adopted here in Utah. So those conversations will probably continue on for years to come, but I feel like it's been a successful and effective model here in Utah.
So. Thank you. I think it was Idaho that, talking to me and Mike, I believe that there are two commissioners, that it just would not happen in Idaho. They didn't want to give up a single permit, as I recall the one fellow's statement, and it's just, they're all different. They really are. If no other comments here.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a favor?
Go ahead.
I see Ryan Fouts is here with Utah Finaz. I think he was probably intended to be here for the discussion on the sheep extension. I know that's already passed, but I'd be interested in hearing if he has anything to say.
Ryan, do you want to come forward?
Too late to change anything, just to let
quickly,
you know.
Quickly, I apologize for being late. I made most green lights, but actually most of them are yellow trying to get here, and I'm sorry that I didn't make that, but just want to let the board know that we do support that extension on those conservation permits. That kind of brings us in line with a lot of the other states and the permits that they sell and the dates that are associated with those sheep tags. So appreciate the board and the vote. I understand it was unanimous, so thank you.
Ryan, can I ask you one other question?
Certainly.
Can you give us an update on the sheep or on the deer transplant there on the Parowan front? Do you have anything there to add?
Yeah. We went down on Sunday night and had a meeting, a kind of a coordination meeting with the Division of Wildlife and the helicopter company, I think it was Dragonfly, and all parties involved. And might I just say that it was probably one of the best projects I've ever been on, just in terms of coordination and partnerships coming together to do, I think, a really good thing. It's going to be interesting to see what the results are, but for the 2 days that we were there, we caught 51 does, 50 of them were pregnant. After the testing, they did a lot of blood work, put collars on them, we ear tagged them, and then we moved them 100 miles north to Fillmore. Surprisingly, from what I could tell, and when we watched most of the does go out of the trailer, they looked really healthy and they were looked in good condition. I mean, time will tell what stress and some of the other things will do to these deer, but if they'll acclimate to the area. But more importantly, it was nice to see everybody come together for a common cause and a common goal, and we're excited to see the results. BYU is doing the all the research on this, and we'll monitor those sheep, and we'll see where we're at. So hats off to the division. Teresa Griffin, specifically in the southern region, for coordinating this. She did a great job, well organized. Leslie McFarland from here, and Anise and Kent. So anyway,
thank you, Ryan.
Thanks.
Can I ask, this is not a question for Ryan, but he might know something about this. I just had heard that some of the desert sheep that have been collared down in the San Rafael area have been killed by lions, and maybe Bill or somebody would want to give us an update on that.
Yeah, Bill probably could. I know we're getting some reports from Rusty Robinson, the BYU student that's doing those. In the last report I got, I think we had two mortalities. Is that right? In the last, I think that's four total. Four on from lions, maybe? I'll let the expert.
Thanks, sir.
Actually, we've had 12 mortalities total on the project, and 8 of those have been from mountain lions. We had two in the last week or last 10 days. So we've got with Wildlife Services, you know, we've tried to get hunters out into there. It's a tough place to hunt, but we've got with Wildlife Services, and Tom Hardy's going to try to set some snares. We'll try to catch that lion. He's just moved in there, and he's focusing in on sheep, and so we feel we have to act fast. But, you know, if we can also work, we'll work with hunters too if we can find any willing to go out there. But
is there any snow out there? I haven't driven out in the swell yet.
You know, I
a little bit, but not
I
much.
Haven't been right there to answer that question, but there is snow out there, but it's probably spotty.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Bill, that was 12 sheep in what time frame?
Well, that's in the course of the study, and so 8 of those have been killed by mountain lions over, you know, over the last 18 months.
Okay. Sheep's an expensive animal.
Oh, it is. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions before I move on? Okay. Dave Gerd, you want to come forward? Dave is from Uinta Basin. He's highly involved for a good reason. You want to tell him what your presentation is, Dave?
Yeah.
And before you start, let me just caveat it. This come because of Dave's presentation to Northeast RAC, and Floyd alluded to it in his presentation. Okay, go ahead, Dave.
Chairman, Wildlife Board and RAC. The topic I was recommending was surrendering permits to disabled veterans. And I'd like to see if a hunter that has drawn out for a permit has a hardship and decides to surrender a permit. As at present, it goes back to, I guess, to the next person in line in the draw. I'd like to see that that person may have an option of either giving it to a disabled veteran or giving it back to the next person in line. And I'm proposed in the Northeast Region RAC meeting that if a person decides to give the permit to a disabled veteran, it goes back to the DWR. The DWR can put it on the website that there's an available permit. And the disabled veteran that wants the permit has to be sponsored by a nonprofit or a charitable or a foundation. And we talked about the VA letter, and the foundation, charity, or whatever will already have candidates for permits with the VA letter with a percent of disability of, let's say, 50 or 60% or greater. And once that the permit, they say they want it, then the landowner or the person that's given up the permit sends in their permit with an affidavit. The charitable organization also sends in an affidavit and the VA letter of the disabled person that wants the permit. And that's kind of what I brought up to the Northeast RAC meeting, and they thought it was a pretty good idea.
Any questions from the board today?
Somebody from the, well, maybe the chairman might, we'll go right to the top.
Okay.
First off, I want to thank you for coming out here. How would we go about, this would take a fair amount of looking into by the division and putting together a plan, making sure we're within statutes and rule and all those kind of things and making sure everything fits.
As I understand, it's going to require a statute change.
So how would we...
And...
How would we go forward with this? Would we have the... Just put it on the action log, have the division look into it, come back and tell us what all would be involved and kind of give us some direction that way? Because I like the idea.
Yeah. There's some good merit in the idea, but it needs to be looked at. And let me just talk out loud for a minute and tell you some of the things that's crossed my desk. Of course, Dave has talked to several individuals in the RAC out there in the Northeast region. And one of those individuals is Representative John Mathis from our region. And John has liked the idea. He called me yesterday. He has already opened a bill for this legislature to address that. But there are some tweaks that have to be tweaked. Questions that I have that I think would go back to the DWR, and that is how many permits have been turned back historically. And Director Sheehan, you have some idea probably. But the other thing, we've already heard from Director Sheehan about Senator Christensen running a bill. And Stacy, you talked about one, the tag-along. This is what I think ought to happen. As we get our senators and our representatives, particularly Christensen and Mathis, together and run this together, and so that it does pass the smell test and passes and then comes back to us.
Make sure one doesn't get in the way of the other.
Yeah.
Well, once it goes through them, it won't come back to us, will it?
No.
It will
no.
just be implemented.
Well,
so
it's going to allow. There's got to be some.
We'll administer it, but the point I'm trying to make is that there won't be any public input except what happens
no.
during the legislative session.
That's
so,
right.
Which sometimes is.
You want to add something, Greg?
This mentoring bill that Senator Christensen has opened has given us a good opportunity to talk through a lot of issues, ideas, positive outcomes, and some of the challenges. One thing that, and I'll just speak the mentoring bill for a second, then we can tie back to the veterans. Some of the things that we discussed in this are if this bill allowed a mentor, say a parent or a grandparent, to transfer that, the use of that permit or the ability for the person to hunt on that permit, that they would need to be in the field, that grandparent or parent with them. So one, we know there's some mentoring going on, and secondly, so that we don't get into a situation with our drawing that we get an influx of people who come in to apply for these permits and ultimately draw them who really never had any intention of going in the field in the first place. We don't want a grandparent, just all, you know, a grandma who's never been hunting in her life to just start being in the draw. You know, somebody's applying for her. She draws a permit and gives it to her grandson or granddaughter and losing that connection with the mentorship. So he said, well, if grandma draws a permit, then grandma's got to go up on the mountain because we know probably an animal may have died anyway. But as we talk about transferring permits or rights, certainly that can be addressed through code. But we've got to make sure that we don't create a new marketplace for our draw where people are now putting in with really no intent, who may qualify. And I think there's certainly some good merits here. Maybe Marty could speak to this as well. But as we move into the legislature, you're right, Mike. One thing for sure is once things get going up there, they can get out of control of us as well very quickly. as amendments are made to bills and different things. One thing we've tried to do, though, with legislation along these lines is to try to have less items be put right into the statute and allow more of this to be directed towards the Wildlife Board to help administer these. The more detail that goes into code, the more tangled up we often get moving forward. So we kind of like some delegated authority to this body. And they've been receptive to that in most cases. So if Representative Mathis has got a bill, certainly we'll be quickly engaging in a dialogue on this and see where we can go with it. But there are certainly factors we want to take into consideration of how does this affect our actual draw for those and who may be involved. So I don't know too much more detail than I've heard today on this or on that legislation. So that's all I could add
okay.
for now.
All I could really add is, Senator Mathis, Representative Mathis has questions that have to be answered and certainly addressed, and numbers and everything, and same with what you're talking about, the grandparent. All I think that we could do, and I like Director Sheehan's comments that we don't want to pass our control on to the legislature. We should have, the board should have some control, being a little bit closer to the source of everything. So I think that what we may ought to do is at least make it an action log item so that it's something that's not forgotten and we address it. And I don't think Representative Mathis is going to do anything that would be unwise, although he's very supportive of Mr. Gurr's presentation. We just need to be careful what we do, and Director Sheehan brought up several examples of what could happen. So there's certainly probably a place for it. We just got to figure out how to do it. Anybody else got any other thing to add to that?
I just, like I said, I think there's some definite merit there. I appreciate you bringing it out and being with us today. And I'd be surprised if down the road here in the near future we don't see some good things come of your proposal. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Can we have a motion to put that on the action log?
Yeah, I'd so move that.
I'll second it.
Okay, a motion made by Calvin, seconded by Mike, that we put on the action log the DWR and whatever, study that issue in conjunction with the other issues surrounding those tags. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you. Now, just for scheduling-wise, at 11 o'clock, we have a time-certain board appeal. What we've completed now is really our current agenda. I'd like to take about a 15-minute break if we can and be back here shortly thereafter so we're ready for that board appeal. And thank you for all coming.